Welcome to the Distance to Empty podcast, the podcast where we talk about 200-mile races, ultramarathons, multi-day shit. I am your host, Kevin Goldberg, and I'm here with everyone's favorite co-host, Peter Noyes. Peter, you're looking pretty funny.
Yeah, I am fully kitted out in my Kettle Mountain apparel. So, yeah, as we mentioned last time, we now have a sponsorship through Kettle Mountain Wear or Apparel. And we've both received a few items. So today I'm wearing the sun shirt, the No Fry sun shirt. I really like it. It's stretchy. It's got thumb holes, so it, you know, will cover part of your hand. Yeah, I just love the hood. It's really loose and big, so you'll get a lot of sun coverage with it. The pants I'm wearing are the Tom Foolery chino pants. Usually I just wear jeans, so I think this is a step up in sophistication for me. I like the zippered pockets. I think that would be great for hiking. I won't lose anything, and it's a great color, and they fit well. Yeah, I'm sold on this brand. It's affordable and very high quality.
Yeah, worth noting that obviously they've given us some free gear, and we're benefiting from any listeners who purchase it. But worth noting that I did find this company and buy something with my own money first, and then just loved it and was like, let me reach out and see if there's anything we can work out. So, and just to give you guys an image here, Peter is wearing the sun shirt with his hood up and his big podcasting headphones over the sun shirt hood. He looks like a little weird leprechaun.
Maybe like a Jawa from Star Wars.
Yeah. That's better. Yeah. But we'll put the link to Kettle Mountain Apparel in the show notes, and if you guys want to support the podcast and get some sweet gear, use that link to check out, and we get a small cut of that, and you guys get some cool stuff. So check it out, Kettle Mountain Apparel, in the show notes of this episode. Peter, what are we up to today?
So today we have a very exciting guest. Her name is Callie Vinson. She has done a number of 200 plus mile efforts. We both did Moab the same year, and she's very inspiring and has had an amazing journey. So can't wait to chat. So without further ado, Callie.
Hey, Callie, welcome to Distance to Empty. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so let's kick things off with kind of giving listeners a rundown of how you got into ultra running and how you find yourself 4.5 weeks away from a 250-mile ultra marathon.
Yeah, I know. I can't believe it's, 33 or so days away? Something like that. I don't know.
Don't put it in days. That's scary.
I know. It's far from now. So far out. Yeah, I guess I got into, just taking a step back, into ultra marathons, not knowing that they existed, first of all. But, you know, of course, I got into running from marathons and road running. And then there was one day I was at the doctor's office and I picked up a Runner's World, and they were talking on the inside about the Western States 100. And in my mind, I'm like, oh my gosh, people are running four times the distance that I'm used to running, and they're doing it on trails, and they're not sleeping. It was just absolutely mind-boggling to me that this was even capable of the human body. And also at the same time, I was immediately intrigued. And I've always been a kind of outdoorsy type. When I was a kid, I was always playing outside. I was always dirty. Always had my shoes off, playing in the mud. And in my mind, this sport just clicked with all the things that I liked. So I discovered that there was a 50-miler pretty close to where I lived in Chicago. So I signed up. I did that. In my mind, I was like, okay, double or nothing. And then quickly signed up the next year for a 100-miler, signed up, did that. And in my mind, that's kind of where it stopped. I was like, okay, we stopped at the 100s. That's all that exists, right? And then shortly after, I learned about the Tahoe 200. I think it was a documentary that Courtney DeWalter had. And in my mind, I was like, that's just absolutely insane. And also absolutely impossible. But also at the same time, I was immediately intrigued. So I signed up to volunteer at the Tahoe 200 in 2019 just to get a feel for it, just to understand who these people are that would sign up for this thing, and also, you know, do some recon, get familiar with the course if I ever wanted to do it. So I signed up for 2020. It was canceled. Signed up again 2021. It was canceled. So I was like, forget it. Forget 200s. I'm going for 240. So I signed up for Moab and at the same time, actually, Cocodona. Cocodona's in May. Moab was in October. So I was like, okay, we're just going to bang these two out in the first year. And I get to Cocodona and everything's going well until it's not. I get to, I think, mile 130. So this was night three. And I had some like medical issues going on and I had to stop. But in my mind, I was like, okay, that's fine. We learned some things. And then went after the Moab 240 in October and I did it in 109 hours. And everything possible went wrong. I learned even more than I thought I would. But I fell in love immediately with the whole journey. The idea that you go night after night and you troubleshoot along the way. I like to think that in 200s, it's not a matter of if things go wrong, it's when and how often. And you just kind of have to learn to adapt and figure it out and keep going, you know, not letting it hold you back or stop you from finishing. And that's exactly what I did. And yeah, since then I've been hooked and I've done another one since Moab. And yeah, like you said, I have Cocodona 250 coming up.
We actually have a little bit of a similar journey. I also DNF'd Cocodona 2022. And then came back and did Moab 240 at the end of it.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah. And I even was signed up for Moab before and then signed up for Cocodona.
Oh, that's funny. A lot of similarities between the two races and the course. Big differences in the distance between aid stations and how much your crew can see you in each of those races. I think my crew saw me like 5 or 6 times total during Moab, but they can see me way more in Cocodona, so that's nice. Also, I had to learn a lot of navigational skills, I feel like, during Moab, whereas Aravaipa will definitely make sure you never get lost, or they try not to, really hard. So that's always nice. But yeah, I'm excited for Cocodona. It's in my backyard because I live in Scottsdale, so yeah, it really is like a victory lap in your own neighborhood.
So what got you into running even to begin with?
Yeah, I got into running because I absolutely hated running. And I know that it makes no sense as far as how those two are connected. But in my mind, well, let me back up even more. Growing up, I always played sports and I love sports. And like I mentioned before, I always loved being outside and playing in the dirt. But as I got older and I went to art school, I was actually going to go to Berkeley to join the rowing team because I got into rowing and I absolutely loved that. But then last minute decided, nope, I'm going to go to art school and not do sports at all. So I went to art school, picked up a lot of unhealthy habits and a lot of partying along the way because you're, you know, in art school. And then graduated, got an internship in Chicago, and I moved to Chicago with all these big dreams. You know, I work in advertising, so I was like, yeah, I'm going to be like the Mad Men style girl in Chicago and, you know, go after it in every single way. But I just got into a point in my life where I was so unhealthy and limiting myself in so many different ways and had zero confidence in myself. And I knew that I had to make a change, but I only decided to actually make a change because one day I would tell the story that my friend invited me to go to brunch and said, oh, it's super close. We'll just walk there. And of course I looked it up because I wanted to see what I was going to order ahead of time. And it was a mile away. In my mind, there was absolutely no way that I could walk a mile to brunch. And so that moment was actually the turning point for me. Up until then, you know, doctors had been telling me, oh, if you continue down this path, you're going to be staring down the barrel of an early death. But in my mind, I'm like, yeah, it's fine. But it was being able to, or not being able to walk to brunch, that was the turning point. So I ultimately started just, you know, making small changes, just making my breakfast every day. Then once I did that for 2 weeks, making my lunch every day. Once I did that, my dinner. And then eventually got a gym membership. I would only go to the gym either early in the morning or early at night because I didn't want people to see me. And I would start with the elliptical or the stair machine. I actually love the stair machine, but I've always hated running. So I never tackled that first, but ultimately I was like, okay, we're going to try this whole running thing because I absolutely hate it. And I started outside again in the dark so that nobody can see me and started just running around the block to see if I could run around the block and try and do that without stopping. Then after one block, two blocks, then a mile, 2 miles, 4 miles. And then one day I was like, you know what? I hear a half marathon is 13.1 miles. I'm going to go do that. So I did that in my neighborhood and it hurt, but I loved it. And I made a huge stack of pancakes when I was done. And then shortly after that, I was standing on the L platform going into work, and the magazine there is called The Red Eye. And so on the cover, they were talking about the Chicago Marathon. And I was like, oh my God, a marathon. I could never, again, could never. But in my mind, I was like, I have to run a marathon. And so I went home later and did all my research on how to get into the Chicago Marathon. I ended up going with a charity bib with Team Paws. So Paws is a no-kill animal shelter in Chicago. And I signed up, I fundraised, and I trained on my own. I never trained with a group. I just looked up like a training plan online and picked up something in Hal Higdon's marathon book. And I got to the starting corral. It was my first starting corral ever. I had no idea how to put a bib on, no idea what pacing was, you know, just go hard the whole time. And I finished and I did it and I was instantly hooked. And yeah, then shortly after that, that's when I learned about ultra marathons, and it was all downhill since then.
And some uphill. that's funny. I blame the Chicago Marathon for like my, like where I'm at today too. My girlfriend, now wife, was, when we met, she was training for Chicago, and it was kind of just like, well, yeah, if I'm going to train, if you're running 3 hour runs on Saturday, I guess I'll just jump in and do that too. And then, back then you could just sign up for the race. That was like one of the last years before it became like impossible to get in. And it was kind of a similar, like, oh, I ran a marathon, and like, oh, there's 50 milers. Oh, there's 100 miler. Like it's, yep. it's a weird slope that we find ourselves traversing. I want to get into sort of the 200 specific journeys, a little bit about your Cocodona DNF, subsequent finishing of Moab, and sort of your approach to Cocodona this year. But first, just want to talk about how your transformation from, you know, being kind of scared to walk a mile to, you know, completing a 240-mile race, like, has sort of, in that process along the way, you've become an advocate for body diversity, inclusivity in general, and specifically in sport, and just an overall source of inspiration for anyone who maybe is also training in the dark or doesn't feel like they belong in the sport. Like, what does that mean to you to be seen as that source of inspiration for those individuals who might feel out of place in the sport or just in general?
Yeah. I never really saw myself, obviously, as an advocate or anyone who could be a source of inspiration. But the farther I got in my journey, the more I heard this feedback of, oh my gosh, like, you ran a half marathon, you're inspiring me to get into running. Or, oh my gosh, you ran a 100-miler, your first one, you inspired me to get on the trails. Like, I think it's been that feedback that made me realize how important this is. Because in my mind, I was like, well, of course I don't see myself as a runner. I don't see myself out there in magazines or on social media. And this was, I don't know, in the 2010s. It's definitely progressed a lot more since then. But I think the more that I realized how little representation there was in diversity in runners' bodies, the more I felt like maybe I do have a voice in this. Maybe I can help somebody, even if just one person. And so that became like a little goal. Like, if I can just keep helping this one person here, this one person there, maybe I can make a difference. Maybe media can change. Maybe the narratives can change on what a runner's body, or a person who's just, you know, an athlete in general, what their body can look like. Because, you know, you grow up trying to find where you fit in, and it's hard to not see yourself somewhere if you don't see yourself in that sport or in that industry. So, you know, just me putting a silly post out or a silly video out, it's what it, you know, what on top of it, what that's doing is putting someone with that body out in there so that somebody else can see it and be like, oh, I look like that. Like, maybe I can run a 200, or, you know, my legs look like that. Maybe I can climb mountains. Because in my mind, I was like, oh, I just have big legs. But now I'm like, no, I have strong legs that can do these things, even though climbing mountains is still hard.
So what advice would you give to someone that's this just starting out on a journey and, you know, looking to you for an inspiration?
I think it has to start with believing in yourself, because no one's going to be able to do that for you. You know, you can hear people say like, oh, I believe in you, you can do this. But, and it's definitely a journey. Like, it's not something that just happens overnight. Like, I believe in myself. But it come slowly. And, you know, if you're consistent and just like continuing to step up to a start line or continuing to show up for yourself and, you know, whatever goals you're going after, you can get to a point where you believe in yourself. And I think a lot of that for me too has come from learning not to care so much about everything. And what I like to say is zooming out to realize where we are. You know, we're on this little rock in the middle of outer space and all the rules are made up and nothing really matters. So it's like, just do it because you find the fun in it. And if you find the fun in it, then can't be much wrong with that, you know? So I always say, like, just go out there and have fun or find the fun in, you know, running, because there's a lot to be had out there.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. And it's so like freeing when you can work towards a learning not to care space. And it's like a kind of a daily battle, because it's so much easier said than done. Like, it's
right.
Like when people say things and you see things, or, you know, it's just like, I read, I think it was a Trail Runner magazine article in kind of preparation for this episode that you were interviewed in. And the mantra was kind of like baby steps. And it reminded, I don't know if either of you guys have seen the, it's an old movie, What About Bob, with Bill Murray and Richard Dreyfuss.
Long time ago.
Yeah. The name of the book that Richard Dreyfuss, like the one of the characters wrote, is called Baby Steps. And he's like, I mean, it's kind of a satirical look at it, but it's just like, you just have to make one change, and you have to do it more often than you don't, right? Like, it doesn't have to, like, if you, like, there's going to be like, you know, 3 steps forward, 2.5 steps back, like it's not linear or perfect, but yeah, I don't really have a question or a point, but that's, that's kind of like how I view it too.
It is true. And that's kind of, you know, how I started with just baby steps, you know, not doing a complete life overhaul all at once, because feel like that's just going to set you up for failure or feeling overwhelmed day to day. But, you know, I just started this whole journey with making my breakfast every day. That was it. You know, I still went out and got whatever I wanted for lunch and dinner and kind of kept that. But, you know, in the back of my mind, I knew those little things would change, but not yet. We don't have to worry about that yet. And it's also that metaphor of, you know, just aid station to aid station. You know, that's how we get to a 200 mile finish line. It's not, oh, I'm doing 200 miles right now. It's, I'm doing 15 or I'm doing 7. And then you get there, you reassess, you got that next goal of getting to the next finish line, and which is the next aid station. And once you get there, eventually you'll get to your finish line, the real finish line.
And then you can sit down.
Kevin, though.
Why? Because I have to go back out and crew you?
No, didn't you say you can't sit down in the first 100 miles?
Yeah. My coach told me I'm not allowed to sit in the first 100 miles, which seems really mean to me. And I don't think I'll listen to him. But
no.
And my coach, I don't know. My coach is Nicodemus De La Rosa, who's like a very compassionate and like not Goggins like mentality style coach. So I'm like, oh, what? We'll see how that plays out. But so Cocodona 250 here, your second go around is in, like you said, 4.5 weeks, 33 days if you're if you want to be a psychopath about it. Let's talk a little bit about the 2022 race. So you were already signed up for Moab, decided to do Cocodona 250 as well. What went wrong? What went right? And what are you bringing from that experience into this year's attempt?
My biggest fear going into that first Cocodona attempt was, am I going to be able to fall asleep? Because I knew that was a mandatory. I have to sleep or else you're really not going to get, I mean, you can, you know, some of those guys, they can get away with like 45 minutes total, but I'm, like you said, I'm not hard. I am very soft. I'm also not a good napper. I don't take naps. If I take a nap, it's like 4 to 5 hours long, and that's sleep. So I was really nervous if my mind would be able to just turn off on the clock. You know, in the back of your mind, in these races, there's always the clock going. You know, for me, it's like cutoff times and the ultimate cutoff time at the finish line. So I was a little nervous that I would not be able to sleep when I get in my car and I'm all tucked in to take a 2-hour nap. And lo and behold, that was no problem. As soon as I laid down, body was out. So very thankful about that. And I've carried that strength, I guess you want to call it, into Moab, into the Maricopa 240 that I just did. And I'm hoping to as well. And Cocodona. Weaknesses at that point in time was definitely fueling and knowing how much sodium I need per, you know, sweat loss. But I live with my partner who is also a coach. And so I hear all the conversations he has and all the points he drills home. And I'm like, that seems like a big point I need to focus on. So I've started, you know, getting into fueling strategies and testing like what really works, because I think that's ultimately what took me out. I also have the weakest stomach in the world, so I really needed to nail this down, because that's what took me out the first year of Cocodona. And so I started playing around with different fueling options, and I'm terrible at chewing stuff while running. Even if I'm walking or hiking or sitting down in the middle of a race, my stomach, just the idea of it being full with food, doesn't like it. So I tested liquid calories, and that worked seamlessly. I don't know what it was. I think it's, you know, the small sips that you continue to take that has calories, that has your electrolytes in it. And for me, I found that that worked really well. And for Moab, I used that strategy, and that worked really well. And Maricopa also. Also, since Maricopa, I learned that I can eat Chipotle just, you know, once a day. But that works really well as like my food source when I'm not having liquid calories. So I have liquid calories for the majority of the time. And then when it's time to like eat a meal before a nap, I'll have a Chipotle burrito. Very simple one. It's just rice, lettuce, and steak. No beans, just money. So if Chipotle wants to sponsor me, I'll take it. Yeah, I'd say fueling, sleep, what else? Gear worked really well. Luckily, I'm keeping my fingers crossed right now, rarely have feet issues. Like my feet were perfectly fine after the Cocodona attempt, perfectly fine after Moab, Maricopa. I'm hoping it's the same thing for this go around at Cocodona. I do now have a shoe sponsor, so now I'll be wearing Topos for the race, but I've been wearing the Topo Ultra Venture and I absolutely love them. So I'm excited to try them out for 250 miles, one pair of shoes usually. And socks, I've been going back and forth with Injinji's and also this like no-name brand nobody knows about called Soft Socks. But they're very similar to Topo, or not to Injinji. They're toe socks. The material is very similar to Feature socks. It's like this stiffer material. And I found that like the less stretch there is in my sock, the less friction there becomes around the skin of my feet. So I'm hoping that, you know, all these shoe strategies work for me as well. Feet strategies. But I don't tape or lube the feet or anything. It's just socks and shoes.
It's funny you say that you bring up that you just got a Topo sponsorship and that you're going to start Cocodona in the Ultra Venture. So I've run all my 200s, 9 of them in Ultra Olympus.
Oh, that's funny.
They tend to work really well for me. I've used Topo off and on throughout the years. And I think I just decided like yesterday that I'm going to start Cocodona in the Ultra Ventures.
Really? Oh, that's so funny.
I've been doing like the majority. I got a few 40% off coupons back in November from friends and family, and I've been doing like the majority of my training in them. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of had the realization that like, you know, you've been putting in the majority of the miles in these shoes. You're not having issues. Like, I feel like my Achilles are starting to hurt a little bit when I go out for long days in the Olympus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think I decided to, so I'm glad that there's other people starting the race in those, because I like 99% sure that that's the direction I'm going in now. And I'll have my Olympus out there for like later, yeah, if I want to switch and whatnot. But that seems to be what's been working for me lately. So
I feel like they're like the cross between an Ultra and a Hoka. Like, it's got the cushion of the Hoka, which I love, but it's got the toe box of an Ultra. So it's like best of both worlds in one shoe. Yeah, I really like them. I wear those for my trail runs, and then for road running, I wear the Spectres. So sticking with the same brand has been helping to like avoid any kind of foot injury and, you know, varying toe drops, or heel drops, but they're working really well.
Do you size up at all? Like, will you size up at all for Cocodona?
I don't usually. Yeah, I usually don't. My feet don't swell too much in races, so I'm very happy about that. And then the only reason I usually change socks is because, this is so gross. The only reason I'll change socks, and for my last two 200s, I only changed them once, is because they'll like decoupage to my feet. And I'm like, okay, you have to get off of the skin. And then I'll change into a fresh pair, and then that'll last, you know, till the end. But I was just on the Cocodona course this weekend, and the creek crossing in Sedona is quite raging. So I might have a change of socks right after that, just because that was intense.
So coming off of the Cocodona DNF, then going into Moab, how did Moab go? Did you apply any of those lessons? You finished, but it sounded like it was still a bit of a struggle. Is that what you said?
It was a struggle for my stomach. I still hadn't gotten to a point where I had nailed down sodium to water ratios. So yeah, the stomach was definitely a knot. And I actually wanted to drop and tried really hard to drop at, what was that, mile 71 or something like that. I was looking at Scott, but he's not there. I tried to drop with, you know, one of the first aid stations where you see your crew, and Scott was like, okay, yeah, that's an option, but how about you just take a nap? We'll think about it when you wake up. I'll pack your stuff. And I was like, no, I'm done. Like, I'm not going through what I just went through at Cocodona with my stomach in knots. I'm not able to keep any kind of nutrition in my stomach at all. And I don't want to do that again. I don't want to do that. And so I tried to drop. I really did. And I wake up from my nap, and he's like, okay, so you're going to, he starts going through all the details of the section ahead. He's like, you're going to climb this much, and it's about this far, blah, blah. I'm like, I don't know if you heard me, but I'm done. And we're done. I've already looked at hotels. And he's like, okay, well, here's your pack. And if you just go up this road, like a mile, just, you know, walk down the road, see how you feel. And if you really, really are done, just walk on back and I'll be right here. And I go a mile down the road. He's like, got the car, like at the road where he's going to turn to go on the highway. And he's like, you still want to drop? And I was like, no. And I just kept going for whatever that was, 170 more miles. But yeah, so I would say the biggest thing that I learned and that I'll take with me into every 200 after this is grit, you know, just to like, and I hate to say like get comfortable with being uncomfortable, but that was very true. The whole race, I was very uncomfortable. My stomach was in knots, but I was having a great time. You know, I was enjoying seeing Moab and just being in the scenery and being on an adventure, exploring places that I've never seen before and that you can only see because your body got you there. And I think otherwise, like all the gear I chose, I would definitely go into Cocodona with. And yeah, poles, that was second time I've used poles. First time was at Cocodona. Yeah, I'm not like a big practice kind of person. I usually just kind of wing it, but I've gotten better at practicing stuff. So I've definitely been practicing, you know, strategies a lot more going into this Cocodona, you know, taking recon of the course a little more seriously and, you know, planning my Excel sheet, which I always do for every race, which is super important to me. And yeah.
So yeah, with the recon of the course and you being lucky enough to kind of live down there with easy access, what are some of the sections that you're most excited for? Are there any that you're kind of dreading? I guess you said you dropped at mile 130, so you made it through Jerome first year, but 2022 was that weird year, so you did like the Skull Valley out and back. So yeah,
so I'm not looking forward to day one and that climb up to Crown King, though I have done that climb before, so I know what I'm expecting. I'm not looking forward to that at all. But I am looking forward to everything that I haven't done. So I haven't done from Munns Park to the finish. I've gone up Eldon, but the road down I've never done. So that'll be new. I'm excited to, you know, see the view from Mingus, of course. I've seen that view, but I was in the dark. So I don't know. Maybe we'll be in the light this time. We'll see. Ooh, another section I'm not looking forward to is coming down from Jerome.
Seems to get worse every year too. Like people put more, like someone comes out and dumps like a jar, like a bucket of glass or something every year.
There's more shards to avoid. I could see that. So not looking forward to that, but I am looking forward to getting to Crown King and moving from there. But I think that climb up to Crown King on the first day is going to be a bitch, but we'll get there.
Yeah. I think like you mentioned, you know, the kind of, getting comfortable being uncomfortable, which is like one of the more cliche things in ultra running, but it's like it is because it's so true. Like one of the hardest lessons I learned early in running 200s is like you could be uncomfortable like pre 50K. Like Like, yeah. It could be so, like, and I think a lot of people are like, well, this is going to be really hard, but not for like 150 miles. Like, it's going to get hard later. So like, the sooner you can like accept that, like, it might be hard from step one and miserable from step one, then you can begin to like you said, still have fun, mm-hmm. still find the enjoyment and the, like, the wonder out there of like, look where my body's taking me. Look at where I am in this, mm-hmm. like, time and space on this rock that's hurtling through the universe. Like, but if you're thinking it's going to be like butterflies and rainbows for the first 100 miles, like, you're in for a rude awakening, especially at Cocodona, where it's like, hey, get up to Crown King. You have, you know, good luck.
And yeah, I think that's one of the big differences in 200s versus 100s. You know, the fact that things can drastically change day by day and you never know. You could have the shittiest day of your entire journey on day one, and then day two might be amazing, and day three might be awful, and day four is like, wow, I'm back again. So being okay with, or at least being aware that things can change no matter the darkest place you've ever been in and how awful that might be. But yeah, like I mentioned, just being able to adapt on the go and, you know, think positive that could get better, could get worse, but you never know.
Yeah, that's been my experience too. Like, even thinking about Moab 2022, I think we had a tough year. It was pretty hot day one. And I can see how, if, yeah, your electrolytes are off, that sets up a painful rest of the race. At least for me, I remember after day one, I was just waiting for it to get cool at night, and it never got cool because we were going against the canyon walls and they were just radiating all mm-hmm. that heat back. Yeah, I think there's some parallels to Cocodona. Day one's also hot, but yeah, I think having your electrolytes in check will make for a, set you up for a much better.
And I've been lucky to have my, to get a blood sweat sodium test done to know exactly where I fall on the line. And I think the average is like 600 milligrams per liter of sweat loss. And I'm like 848, but I know that can go up to like 1600. So, which I couldn't even imagine if your sweat rate was like that, like how much salt you'd actually have to take in. That's a lot of management. But yeah, what I usually do is just rely on Guroctane for a lot of the electrolytes, and then I'll supplement with salt tabs and call it a day.
Do you vary that throughout the race, like temperature dependent, or is you just stick to that?
I think that ratio of, you know, how much I'm drinking to how much sodium I'm taking in will stay the same, but the amount of hydration and, you know, sodium I take in, that'll change based on the temperature and how much I'm drinking, but that ratio of water to sodium, that ratio will always stay the same.
So obviously we're, you know, you and I both are kind of in the peak training phases for Cocodona right now from a physical training perspective. And I don't know about you, but like, I feel like when I'm well rested and like energized and the sun is out, I'm like really excited about Cocodona and like just like stoked about it. And then like, if I'm getting tired or it's nighttime or like the training for the day is done, I'm kind of like dreading Cocodona. Like, it's like, it's almost like my take on Cocodona is like dependent on like my overall like mood.
You can definitely see that. Yeah. I'm like, towards the end of the day, I'm like, oh my God, like, I'm just imagining right now going into like night two and how awful it must be. And I don't want to experience that again. And then come the morning, like on a, you know, short run, when you're feeling the runner's high, you're like, this is great. I'm so excited to go do this for 4 or so days.
100%. So it's like this roller coaster of like emotions that are all centered around like where you'll be in 4.5 weeks. But are you employing any, and you know, definitely not asking for myself, are you employing any like what are your mental strategies or mental training leading up to the race? Like, are you addressing those feelings, or are you just, you know, riding them? Like, is there anything like strategic surrounding that?
I think for me, what I like to do is place things, not physically, but maybe it's just, you know, like, because it's along the journey, place things throughout the race to look forward to. So that always gives me something within reach to, you know, aim for or strive for, or feel like, oh, it's just, you know, a little bit farther away, or I'll get to that this afternoon. And just having that little like carrot to dangle, you know, for, you know, each day or like half day, it gives me, I don't know, more motivation to keep going. I'm also just, you know, insatiably curious to see how far the body can go and to be on this adventure. Something that I just like to tell myself going into these big races or even just a long run, that, you know, I'm just going on an adventure, and when I'm done, I'll be done. But for now, we're just going to be outside and enjoy it. And you're going to get to see things and experience things that you don't get to experience on a day to day. Something else that I'll do, just, you know, mindset before the race even starts, is I won't go outside a lot, like the week before a race. Like, I'll kind of just stay hunkered down and work and, you know, try and relax or find things to do inside, so much to the point that I'm so looking forward to just being outside for so long, you know, because it will get to the point where you're in a race and you're like, I just want to be inside, comfortable, showered, sitting down, having my snacks. But I think the more I can force myself to stay inside, the more I want to be outside in the race, and, you know, the less that feeling pops up. So that's a little mindset strategy I do before the race even starts. But during the race, it's more about like having these little small carrots to dangle throughout the race to look forward to.
That's a great strategy. I never thought about that, but just to like visualize, you know, getting rewards throughout the race, and like if there's a particular like smoothie place or something, or just anything that to look forward to. I love that.
A big thing to look forward to is my pacers are all starting like in the afternoon of each day, going to the morning. So when they leave in the morning, then it's like, oh, I get to look forward to a new pacer jumping in later this afternoon. So I'll get the day to myself to be, you know, around whoever's around me, and then I'll get my pacer, you know, in the afternoon. So that's a big thing to look forward to. And it's funny, I never had pacers or even a crew until I was going after Cocodona for the first time. I've always done hundreds or 50s by myself, more so because I don't want to ask anyone for help. And I don't like the idea of someone waiting for me and that pressure of like, oh, I've got to get there by the certain time. I told them I'd be there between this window, and that just, you know, eats in my brain. Again, that idea of like, I'm just going on this adventure by myself. I like that. But I realize in 200s, like, sure, you can get it done without pacers or a crew, but it's kind of a nicer experience, you know, to share it with someone. And so I feel like I look forward to that part too in these kinds of races.
So clearly you're drawn to this 200 plus mile distance.
Yeah, so, even though I love sleep, so I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, so would love to learn more about the Maricopa FKT and what inspired you to do that, and what that is.
Yeah, so the Maricopa Trail is a trail that circumnavigates all of the valley. And the valley is Phoenix and all the, you know, surrounding cities like Scottsdale, Glendale, yada, yada. And it connects all these regional parks along the way. And I've always been on the Maricopa Trail just because, you know, it just happens to be where I might be training that weekend. And I had heard about Joshua Locke doing the Maricopa Trail, and that's when I learned, oh, this all connects together. And I realized that he went after an FKT, and I was like, oh, there's an FKT. And so I've always wanted to do an FKT. I actually tried to do one back in Chicago. There's a 200 miler that goes all the way around Chicago called the Outer Belt Trail, but it never really happened. So that's always been in my mind to do something, you know, in my neighborhood or my city, just something on my own, not an event. And so after learning about Joshua Locke's FKT, I went and looked and saw if there was a woman's record. And I saw that there was recently. She did it in 109 hours. And so my time at Moab was 109 hours. So I was like, okay, I just have to do a little better than that. That's possible. And originally I was thinking, okay, I'm going to do this by myself. Cause again, I don't like asking people for help. And I figured, oh, there's so many places where you can, you know, fill up at a gas station or whatever. But the more research I did, I was like, oh, you're in no man's land for a long time. So then I was like, okay, let's ask the people for help. So I put out a call saying like, whoever wants to help, you know, me go after this. I'm looking for people to go after a supported FKT. And I was overwhelmed with the number of people who reached out, and I ultimately whittled it down to just 26 people to help out with this, which at times made me feel more like a race director than the runner, just organizing logistics. Because, you know, when you're going after an FKT, you're just looking at a blank map and you're like, okay, where are my aid stations? when am I going to be there? What, you know, what am I going to need there? Is that park open in the night? And am I going to be there during the middle of the night? So there was a lot of logistics that went into it, but it's weird because at the end of it, you know, people ask, oh, how'd it go? And it eerily went well. Nothing, absolutely nothing went wrong. I never bonked. I never had a low moment. I never got lost, thankfully. no gear mishaps, nothing. The only like thing that went kind of wrong was it got a little sketchy in some parts because you're in sketchy parts of Phoenix. But otherwise, it went really well. But I loved that whole experience because it was bigger than just me going after a record. It was about the trail community. It was about the running community coming together for this one goal and, you know, doing everything that we all can to make it happen. So at the end of it, I loved it the most because of that, not because of the record or anything like that, but because it was, you know, the essence of our community that we love all coming together to get this thing done. And at the end of it, I did get the record. I did it in 103 hours. So I shaved a little time off, but I was also planning to go into that getting about 8 hours of sleep total, but I ended up getting like 4 or something. So not as much sleep that I would have wanted, but it was fine. I got some Chipotle and got to hang with a lot of great people. So it was good.
I was going to say, looking at that route, probably had pretty good access to Chipotle as far as FKT routes go.
Yeah, there were a lot of them around. Yeah. So I ended up having 4 burritos along the way. So it was good.
Nice. But beyond the logistics, which obviously are like very different and much more intricate and intense versus, I mean, planning for something like Kokodona or Moab, which is also a lot of logistics, but less and different. How much like did it differ like actually running it? Like, did it feel like you were out there at Kokodona or Moab? Was it like a similar or like was the solo FKT style vibe like totally different?
It was kind of same and different. It was the same in that you're doing this big effort and it's going to be multiple days and you're going to have your crew and you're going to have pacers, but it was different because, you know, sometimes in these big races, you're like, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm just out here doing this silly distance of 200 plus miles. And why am I? And you feel that even more so in an FKT when you're the only one out there doing it. Whereas if you're in a race, you're like, oh yeah, there's all these other crazy people who are out there with me. We're all in this together and I'll see people eventually and I'll get to an aid station and there'll be all these people like wanting to help you and whatnot. And in an FKT, it's, again, you're by yourself or with a pacer and there's no one out there. There's no cheering. There's no live stream. There's no swag, which is fine. I'm totally fine with that. But it's funny because some of the aid stations were like actual aid stations. You know, there'd be like 6 people there all dressed in unicorn onesies with a boombox and lights and glow sticks. And I just sat in one of their cars. I didn't even know whose car it was. And I was just eating my burrito and they're all like cheering on the outside. So it was fun. It was same but different. But yeah, definitely a different mindset when you know you're the only one trying to go after this.
Wondering, you know, more about the attempt, just like, did you set it up more as, like aid stations, like you said, or was the car ever tracking you and, you know, getting aid, you know, more regularly, or how did you manage that?
Yeah, the aid stations were definitely closer apart than say in a Moab or Kokodona. But there was never a time when the car would be, you know, right by my side, even though there were lots of places where that could happen. To me, it would have felt like, again, that pressure to like keep up with a car or get to this point by a certain time. Whereas I like to have that solitude or that like breathing room between aid stations where you're just enjoying the journey. You're just enjoying the process and kind of embracing it and savoring it. But yeah, my partner, my main crew person was pushing for more aid stations. Like, oh, you could have it here, 2 miles away, here, 2 miles. But I was like, no, let's just do it around more like 10 miles away as an average, just to, again, not have to plan more logistics, but also just have more room and more space between to enjoy it.
So with all these 200 milers, do you have any other sort of dream races on your radar that you want to tackle in the future?
I think in the way back of my mind, I have always wanted to go after bad water. It's not a 200 per se, but 135. I love running in the heat way more than I like running in the cold, and I'm from Florida, so like the heat is just in me from experiencing that my entire life, minus the 10 years in Chicago. But that race has always just, I don't know, appealed to me, or I've just always been drawn to it because it's a whole different kind of challenge. And there, yeah, your car is right beside you. And I'll actually be there this year, crewing our friend. So a little recon. And then other than that, I don't know if it's because it's going on right now or it was, but the Speed Project, as a solo runner, that's kind of always been on my mind too, just because it's pretty local-ish and it just looks like, you know, like, I don't know, a good time, like just bandits on the run, you know, kind of style going across from Vegas to, or from LA to Vegas. Is it LA to Vegas? Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of been a draw to me too. But I've been talking to Izzy about that. We're scheming plans to get there maybe next year, but we'll see.
Nice. Yeah, we just actually had a guest on yesterday who had just finished the Speed Project like two days prior. Like he was still like, you know, sleepy from it. Like it was like, and it just, it sounds like totally epic. And it honestly, there are like a lot of parallels between that route and Badwater and just kind of the style of that race. I think Peter and I will also be out crewing for our first Badwater this year. So.
Oh, too funny. Well, maybe I'll see you guys out there.
Yeah.
And you might see me Badwater 2025. That's my goal also.
I know when I'm there in July, I'm going to have a little chat with the race director and be like, remember my name because I'm signing up.
I think that's what it takes. You have to like pull him aside and tell him like, hey, I'm going to, this is, remember the name. Awesome. Well, we like to wrap these episodes up with kind of a quick five rapid fire style questions. So let's dive into that. So first thing that comes to mind, no right or wrong answers. You can, you know, forget or change it later and it'll be okay. let's start with what's been your highest high ever in a 200?
Ooh. Okay. So in Cocodona, there was this moment where I was going up like the last climb and I was going so slow that I noticed a little inchworm making his way across this little road, just like classic cartoon looking little green inchworm, like it doing the scoot across. And I was like, I feel like this guy is me right now. Like he's got such a long way to go to get across to the other side. But you know, he's just scoot by scoot getting there, and I felt like, you know what, that's me in these races, just scoot by scoot gonna get to Flagstaff. That was a high.
Lowest low in a 200?
So in the Maricopa the last night, because I knew it was the last night, I was gonna finish in the morning, so I was like, okay, I'm not gonna sleep. I was very sleep deprived, and this was the first time I actually hallucinated. I've never in a 100 or in a 200 before, but I was so tired. In my mind, I was like, I know those are palm trees in someone's backyard and there's a light shining up at it, but my brain was making it out to be these huge teddy bears in the back of this person's backyard. And I, you know, as much as I like was clearing my eyes, it still looked like teddy bears. And I wish I had taken a picture to look back on it later, but I'm pretty sure they had teddy bears in the backyard. And then I saw some other things in the trees right after that, but it was low because I was so tired that I was about to fall asleep in the canal of the canal path. Like I was swaying into it to the point where Jackie was like, you've got to get to my left because you're about to fall in. I'm not diving in there to get you. And I just remember like hoping for the sunrise to come earlier than it was supposed to, because I knew as soon as I saw the sun or like the orange glow on the horizon, like I knew it was going to be okay, but it was not okay because I was so tired before then, because I could not take a sleep, or I couldn't fall asleep on the trail. Otherwise, I would have froze. So I just had to keep going.
All right. This next one I'm going to alter a little bit because we know the answer. So this question is assuming that on May 6th, Chipotle announces a national closure for a week. That won't really happen. Okay. What's your favorite food for a 200 other than Chipotle steak burrito?
Chipotle. Man, I had some pot stickers during Cocodona, and that was that was pretty epic. Anything that's like in a little like potato dough pocket, I'm all for. So pierogies, pot stickers, I'm all for them. Pizza rolls, that's good.
In LA, we have this place called Porto's that has these little potato balls that are amazing. Mm-hmm. So if you do the speed project, have someone get you Porto's.
I'm going to write that down.
All right. favorite piece of gear for a 200?
Probably my poles. I use those a lot to like, you know, later in the race to just lean on and like stretch the back out and stretch the back of the hammies. Also during Maricopa, my right quad was so tight going over the last mountain range, and I would just take the poles and just roll them over my leg. And that was a game changer. So they're great for hoisting you up, keeping your balance, leaning on to stretch and to roll your muscles out. So they're multifunctional.
You know, I do that all the time too. I don't think I've ever heard someone else doing the foam, well, not foam, roller yeah. style with the trekking poles. I use it on like my like tib out, like my shin muscles, mm-hmm. like all the time. All right, final question. We all know the answer, but it's the theme of the podcast, so we have to ask it. Have you found your distance to empty yet?
No. No.
Cool.
Gonna keep going.
Yeah. All right, thanks, Callie. We had a blast chatting with you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Man, that was fun. Callie is just a super awesome person and really inspirational, and very excited to see what she does at Kokodona this year for redemption.
Yeah, I'm really rooting for her as someone who had a similar journey of needing redemption at Kokodona. I'm going to follow and cheer her along.
Yeah, you guys had a very similar track there with Kokodona Moab, and then you just went back to Kokodona a year earlier than her is all.
Yep. All right, so performance of the week.
Let's do it. Let's have you do it.
So performance of the week, we'll do a little differently this time. So in our distance to empty Strava group, last week we had four different athletes do 100-mile week. So that's a big benchmark in training to get that amount of volume in. Kevin, you're one of them. And then also we have Thomas Watson, who's doing Kokodona. And then we have Chad Bruce, who's also doing Kokodona.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A trend.
Yep. Yep. And then Joel Frosthift, who I do not think is doing Kokodona, but he's an amazing athlete in his own right. So four athletes at that 100-mile mark. Huge.
Yeah, we all got together and decided to do a 400-mile relay. So that's what that was. That's not true. I just made that up. But yeah, thanks for the shout out, Peter, and to those guys. It was you certainly don't need to do 100-mile weeks to do well in 200-mile races or to complete 200-mile races. But that's what some of us are doing, and it's a lot of work.
Well, the good news is you get to eat a lot of snacks.
Oh my God, I've had so many snacks. Speaking of snacks, we just tried some really good ones for our snack review. So Peter and I have ordered no affiliation with Galactic Snacks, but that's where we've been ordering our kind of exotic snacks from around the world from. We have two snacks that we tried today, and one of them was actually given to us by a friend of ours, Kevin Tiffany, who went on vacation to Costa Rica and found a tasty snack that he brought a bunch back with him and mailed them to me and Peter. So they're called Yippies, Y-I-P-Y, I think, Yippie bars. And yeah, what do you think of your Yippie bar, Peter?
Yeah, they're great. They go very well with coffee. They're like a double stacked high, like waffle cake thing coated in chocolate. And my only concern would be if a hot race, they'd melt, but otherwise they taste great. They go great with coffee.
Yeah, I actually have been using them on my runs since Kevin sent us those, but it's been like in the 50s and 60s here, so no melting yet, but they're pretty tasty, like vanilla wafer, like chocolate bar things. We also tried, these are kind of a like familiar feeling sour candy. They're Crazy Sour Skittles Squishy Clouds. These look like they're a new candy in the UK. And yeah, they're just like delicious, like softer versions of sour Skittles.
Yeah, they're really good. Yeah. As you all probably have heard, my go-to is sour candy in these races. You know, I started with Sour Patch Kids. I still like them, but the texture of a Sour Patch Kid is just a little more firm, and it gets harder to eat them during a race. So I've kind of switched to Trolley, but these are equally as good, if not better. Yeah, they're soft, they're chewy, they're sour. So yeah, these would be great in a race.
Yeah, agreed. All right, we put out a call for some listener questions. So shall we take some time and answer some of these listener questions, Peter?
Let's do it.
All right. We actually have two really good questions from JessLynn2213 on Instagram. So the first one is, how to stay on top of eating in freezing cold conditions? My hands get numb when managing food in a race. That's definitely a challenge for me too, later in races if it's cold. What I tend to do, not always for the cold, just for like when I get sick of eating or have having trouble eating, I will switch to like a high calorie liquid source. So like a Scratch high carb mix or a Never Second high carb mix, or a lot of these companies have these like high carb drink mixes now that are just easier to kind of get down and less to fuss with when you're later in a race. So I think that would be my tip for when things, you know, if it's really cold and you're having trouble eating, just kind of putting that, that, you know, high concentration of calories into a liquid form. And that also keeps you hydrating, through the night or through the colder times when you might otherwise back off on hydration too much.
Yep. Some good tips, for me on this one. Yeah, I definitely have struggled to eat when it's cold, especially, if my hands are cold and I can't open gels and things like that. So yeah, I agree. Just, yeah, liquid calories, good fallback.
All right, Peter, you can take this one. Also from Jess Lynn, I have trouble staying warm when running in freezing rain for more than 3.5 hours. Best advice or gear?
Best advice in the rain. Yeah, I think find a jacket that really works for you, that truly is waterproof. You know, a lot of the different jackets claim to be waterproof, but in fact, do soak all the way through. So my preferred one, I have a Gore-Tex jacket that's my go-to that actually is very rain resistant. So I'd start there. And then the other advice I have is just really layer up. Like wool is a great material that actually retains warmth even if it is wet. So think about layering base layers.
Yeah, puffy under a raincoat is always a good go-to, like a down puffy. And yeah, if you're not, unfortunately, like the truly waterproof jackets are usually like $300 to $400. So if you're getting a rain jacket that costs $99, it's probably not waterproof. And also Z-Pax makes a rain kilt. I really like the rain kilt because it keeps the water off your shorts and is not as clunky as rain pants. Let's see. Matt Ultra Runner on Instagram says, how do you ride out the long lows during a 200 with no pacer or minimal crew support? Peter, I seem to recall a long stretch at Moab 240 where you requested a fresh pair of shorts, but weren't going to see your crew for another like 10 hours. How did you ride out that low?
For me, you know, all the 200s I've done, you know, where I'm at in the race, you know, sort of the front of the middle of the pack, you're never really alone. There's enough people that you end up being able to meet up with other people in the race. So I'm pretty chatty out there. So you know, I'm when I was in that low with no shorts, I actually teamed up with a really fun group, and I was with them for a lot of the time. So I think that's my suggestion.
Just to clarify, Peter, you had shorts. You wanted a new pair of shorts. You said you were running with no shorts. You were clothed out there.
Yeah, that is correct. I had a chafing issue. I needed new shorts.
Yeah, I would say my advice on that is more on like the psychological side of things. Is like long lows are going to happen. They're like it's inevitable in these races. So I like to spend a lot of time before the race like expecting them, and like so like when they come, it's more of like you're welcoming them in, and you know, letting them have a seat for a while, and then like, you know, entertaining them to the best of your ability, but just knowing that it's going to happen and then it will pass is really helpful if you can really spend some time kind of, you know, getting comfortable with that fact before the race starts, so that when it does happen, it's not a surprise, it's not unexpected. It's like, okay, I knew this was coming. It's not going to be fun, but we're going to get through it. All right, Peter, this one's just for you. FrancisPicard28 on Instagram.
Oh, no.
He says, explain us.
Yeah, us, I think, is just we have a small group of friends that that we go on some pretty fun adventures with, and things get silly, things get weird, and we just have a ton of fun out there. So yeah, especially the three of us, Francis, Kevin, and I, we've had a crazy Hawaii trip, U-Ray, yeah, a lot of fun adventures, and all rental cars beware.
Oh dear. All right, a couple more here. We have Lance on Trails and your wife on Instagram reached out about some swag. And by your wife, I mean Peter's wife. Lance on Trails wants to know if they can get a distance to empty calendar with Peter and Kevin experiencing highs and lows during a race. And Jenna wants to know when we're going to start selling merch. So similar questions. We did just get some sweatshirts made for ourselves. It's not cheap getting custom gear made. So I don't know if we're going to have any official gear in any capacity, but if that's something people are interested in, I suppose let us know and we'll see what we can do. And yeah, I think we should get to work on a calendar of maybe all Peter's lows.
I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but I seem to have a lot of lows in these races, but it's fun for everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I think I'll do one more from Run Dog Mom Run. I don't know if you saw the story where I asked questions on Peter, but Run Dog Mom Run wants to know whose pig is that and how can I meet them?
Sadly, the pig was only here temporarily. We fostered the pig, so the pig had to find a new home. That pig overstayed its welcome.
But that was a birthday picture of Stella the pig, so it was a great picture.
Yeah, no, we enjoyed the pig while it was here.
All right, last segment here, last category. Let's get deep.
Let's do it.
All right, Let's Get Deep is a card game for couples that Peter and I play for your entertainment. Three categories, icebreaker, deep, and deeper. Peter, I'll kick it off with your icebreaker. If you had to permanently move to a new country, where would you go and why?
Great question. I guess of all the countries I've visited, I'd probably say Costa Rica. I was just there last year on vacation as well. And, you know, it's a great place, great people. There's the rainforest, there's the beach. It seems like a lot of fun areas to explore and run, and the cost of living is pretty low, so I think it would be an all-around fun place to spend some time in.
And get some yippie bars.
All right, icebreaker for you. What is your favorite dessert?
Probably cookies. I really like most of them, but like a really good chocolate chip cookie is probably my favorite. I mean, I'm a big dessert guy. I like it all. I have ice cream almost every night because that's Melanie's favorite dessert. I'm a huge candy guy, so even like a bag of sour candy would pass as like a great dessert for me. But yeah, cookies probably trump it all. Just like a really good fresh cookie.
Softer.
Both, but soft if it's from like a restaurant or a bakery. Crunchy if it's from like a bag, like a grocery store.
All right.
All right, deep for you. What is your most impressive skill?
I don't know about most impressive, but I can juggle. I feel like I can just do the three balls, but in a few different variations, and so that usually impresses people when I pull that out.
Have you ever run while juggling?
I can. I should do that.
Yeah, I just saw on social media somewhere someone did like a 1:17 half marathon while juggling the whole time.
I can't do that.
I can't do that without juggling.
Okay. Deep for you. What song reminds you of your partner? I guess that's me in this case.
Best Friend by Doja Cat. Oh. I think that's who sings that, right?
I don't know, but...
Well, let's pretend. Oh my God, there's a doodle in your screen. It's going away. Peter's dog walked into the room. Okay, is it my turn? Deeper?
Yeah.
All right, deeper for you. What is something you do when no one is home?
When no one is home, I binge watch TV sometimes. I recently just got a subscription to the Peacock. So now it's got a ton of old series I like Parks and Rec and The Office and House and all these other ones. So yeah, binge watch TV.
We've been watching The Traitors on Peacock. And I don't know if you ever played like Mafia or Werewolf, like those like group games growing up, but it's basically like a televised game show version of those games. And it's really fun. Like there's a US version, a UK version, an Australia version, and now a New Zealand version. And they're all like relatively high production and good. And it's highly recommended, especially if you played some of those games growing up.
I'll check it out. We play a lot of One Night Ultimate Werewolf.
Yeah, it is. It's One Night Ultimate Werewolf in like game show form.
Fun. All right. And then deeper for you. Do you consider yourself to be more emotional or more logical? Why?
Man, probably more logical, but I'm not immune to emotions by any means. I definitely have some pretty big emotional swings. So I think I'm a pretty good blend of both. But if I had to pin one, I'd say logical, because even when I am swinging emotionally one way or the other, I tend to try to break it down logically. So like, I guess that overpowers it-ish.
That's probably a good 200 tip there, is like try to get yourself to be more logical than emotional.
Yeah. Yeah. Easier said than done.
Yep. All right. Well, I think that wraps up the game.
That's it. Thank you for listening. Hope you guys enjoyed our chat with Callie and our witty banter afterwards. We'll catch you next week. And if you haven't already, please leave us a review. We love seeing new reviews. We got to like do one of those things where we tell them to like stop what you're doing, pause the episode, review now. You know, like when you hear in like the middle of a podcast or something. People already stopped listening by now. I bet they're not listening to this. Anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.